For the past 20 years, Dr. Elaine Ostrander has been studying canine genetics. Currently, she's chief of the cancer genetics branch at the National Human Genome Research Institute. It's part of the National Institutes of Health. Her focus is on identifying the genes that make dogs and humans susceptible to cancer and other diseases. Welcome, Elaine.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sure. So I understand that cancer is the number one killer of dogs, and though humans are doing somewhat better in the fight against cancer, actually, I know there was a news story about it today, we obviously still have a very long way to go. Is your research aimed at helping dogs or humans or both?
Absolutely, at helping both. So you're right. When it comes to disease, cancer is really the number one killer of dogs. And what we've learned about the canine genome is that there's dramatic similarity between the canine and the human genome. And for diseases that have been studied extensively so far, we're finding it's really the same portfolio of genes and gene families that are responsible for similar diseases in humans and dogs. So when we make progress in learning about the genes that increase susceptibility to a particular canine disease, whether that be epilepsy or cataracts or heart disease or blindness or deafness or cancer is our interest, then we're almost certainly learning something about genes that increase susceptibility to human cancers as well.
So how do you study the genes of dogs?
So it's really been a wonderful partnership with people in the community. So we work with breed organizations like the American Kennel Club, the Canine Health Foundation, the Kennel Club in Europe, and we collect DNA samples, often in the form of cheek swabs, sometimes in the form of a blood sample if a vet can provide one of those. And we isolate the DNA from the sample, and then we collect information about the dog's health, the dog's family history, what sorts of diseases run in the family, how old the dog is, and what its general health has been like so far. And then we use that information eventually to build a data set of cases or of families that have a particular disease or have susceptibility to a particular disease, and then groups within the same breed who don't seem to have that disease or susceptibility to it. And then using a variety of genomic tools now available because of the sequencing of the canine genome, we can compare the genome of those who get the disease and those who don't, and then find genomic locations or neighborhoods of the genome where we think the genes responsible for those key differences lie. And then we close in on those, eventually getting down to the small number of bases that are really responsible for causing the disease or for increasing susceptibility to the disease.
And you have some big news to report now about a collaboration that's really going to make a difference in your research.
We do. We are very, very fortunate to have been able to pair with the group in San Rafael, the Guide Dogs for the Blind, and they have an amazing database of information on dogs that have been bred and trained and provided as service dogs to people throughout the country and throughout the community who provide really an invaluable service, largely in terms of helping the blind, but certainly in terms of helping others as well. And what they've done is they've taken just exquisite care to keep a chronology of those dogs. So we know those dogs' ancestors back, you know, multiple generations. And we know everything that there is to know about the health of those dogs. And we know how those dogs do once they go out into the community in terms of how well they perform as service dogs. And so it gives us a terrific opportunity to look at diseases that plague all companion animals and also plague humans as well, like lymphoma, and try and study this very, very beautifully well-characterized population of animals and see if we can use them to find the genes that increase susceptibility to some of the more common forms of cancer.
So is this a collaboration that begins now with the dogs that they're breeding right now, or do you actually utilize records of dogs that they have bred in the past?
Well, this group is so visionary that not only have they kept records of dogs in the past, but they've also kept DNA samples. And so every dog that comes through their breeding program or that they produce, they keep a DNA sample of that dog, as well as these extensive medical histories, family history data, you know, basically anything you would want to know about the dog, from its coat color to who its great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was, and then, of course, the all-important DNA. So we're actually able to make use of events that took place in history, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of years ago, as well as events that are taking place today, dogs that are sadly coming down with cancer today.
That's really quite amazing. How many dogs are we talking about?
You know, we're certainly talking on the order of thousands. And so this is probably the most well-maintained, well-documented cohort of dogs that exists. And what's so visionary about the group that's been overseeing and these dogs for so many years is, you know, they really thought ahead long before there was a canine genome project or a canine genome map, long before there was a human genome project. They were thinking about the things that they wanted to do in order to produce the healthiest, most long-lived dogs that would be the very best service dogs that they could possibly provide. And I think in some sense they knew that DNA would ultimately be key to doing that, as well as these very, very good health records that they've kept on all the dogs throughout their life. And so it's truly the most amazing archive of information any scientist could ever want.
You've been studying all of this in various different ways, obviously, for 20 years. Have there been any results that the larger non-scientific lay public would find interesting?
There have been lots. You know, there have been a lot of disease genes now that have been uncovered in dogs, many in the last year or two. And they've given us information about everything from what kinds of genes are responsible for blindness, like retinitis pigmentosa, to what kinds of genes are responsible for metabolic disorders, like inability to metabolize copper or Wilson's disease in humans. But they've also started to give us other really interesting insights. So my own group, together with several others, are involved in studying the genetics of morphology. What makes big dogs big and little dogs little? Why do Chihuahuas have short legs and Great Danes have long legs? And we've had some interesting findings where we've been able to identify some of the genes and certainly the genomic regions that are responsible for some of those differences. And I think that's really interesting to people because, you know, we all have the same blueprint, and yet there are a lot of differences between us. And so the fact that we can use dog populations and DNA samples from dogs at the dog park and dogs at the dog show and dogs at the obedience trials in order to pinpoint the genes that are responsible for some of those differences, I think it's really exciting to people. And I think that's going to just continue to grow and expand as time goes on.
Why is it that purebred dogs are of such great interest to you in your research?
You know, both purebred and mixed breed dogs are of interest, but our research tends to focus on purebred dogs because of the record keeping. So in order to be a registered member of any breed, you know, a poodle, both of your parents have to have been registered members of the same breed, and their parents in turn registered members of the same breed. So that has two really profound effects. One is it gives us great record keeping. We're able to track very carefully who's related to who and where disease genes may have come in from. But more importantly, what it does is there are about 155 recognized breeds in the United States of dog. There are over 300 breeds that are recognized worldwide. But what's important in the pure breed world of dogs is that you don't very often find crossing of dogs from one breed to another. So every breed is effectively a closed population, an isolated population. And so if you think about something like epilepsy, where there may be a dozen genes responsible or even more in humans, and there's probably just as many in dogs, but within any single breed, there's probably only going to be one or two. And the reason for that is most breeds have only been around for 200 or 300 years. A large number of them were started in Europe, and they were initiated from a very small number of dogs who had a particular set of traits that someone was really trying to propagate and create a breed around. And so there's probably only been one disease allele or one disease mutation that's gotten in that's associated with for instance, the example I gave of epilepsy or of retinitis pigmentosa or particular kinds of valve disease associated with heart problems. And so that gives us a lot of statistical power for tackling this question. When we look at something like cancer in humans, and half of my lab works on cancer in humans, we're always struggling with the fact that there's so many cancer genes out there for many of the common kinds of cancer. And in dogs, we have these sort of little subdivided islands in the forms of breeds, where even for a common cancer like lymphoma, within any one breed, there aren't going to be 25 susceptibility genes. There's probably going to be a much more modest number, and it makes it a much more tractable problem.
It's absolutely fascinating. Have you found, for instance, that there are certain cancers that are more prevalent in certain breeds of dogs?
Sure. That's been reported by many, many scientists over the last two, three, four decades. And so things like bladder cancer, which aren't terribly common in dogs as a whole, you tend to see much more in Scottish Terriers, West Highland White Terriers, Beagles, and a couple of other breeds. And so for Scottish Terriers, that's not a trivial disease. Their risk of getting the disease is about 20-fold higher than it is for the average mixed breed dog walking down the street. And that's true for a lot of different kinds of cancer. Malignant histiocytosis, which is a kind of very rapidly fatal soft tissue cancer, is a disease that is just a terrible disease that we see in Bernese Mountain dogs and flat-coated retrievers, occasionally in Rottweilers or in Golden Retrievers, but really it's mainly in the flat-coated retrievers and the Bernese Mountain dogs. And yet in other breeds, you know, veterinarians tell us that they never see a single case in their entire career. And so, again, that offers us some real advantages in terms of the genetics, because we can cluster data sometimes from those breeds, particularly if we know they likely share a common founder. That is, if they're breeds that are really very, very closely related one to another, like some of the terrier breeds are. And again, that just increases our power for both finding the neighborhood in the genome where the mutation is and then actually honing in on what exactly the bases are in the DNA that are incorrect, that are actually responsible for the disease.
How do mutts, mixed breed dogs, hold up against purebred dogs when it comes to incidence of cancers?
It'll depend actually on what mixed breed, what purebred dogs went into making up the mutt. So, you know, we tend to think of mutts as sort of just a mongrel and a mix of a little of this and a little of that, a little of this and a little of that. You know, and in fact, mutts are often a mix of just two or three purebred dogs. And so it really just depends on what went into making up those individuals. And so if it's a combination of breeds that have a really high incidence of lymphoma, then sure, that dog may have an increased incidence of lymphoma. And it depends whether or not you need two mutant copies of the gene or one mutated copy of the gene in order to get the disease. In general, mutts tend to be healthier when we think about inherited disease. And the number you hear quoted a lot is about twofold, that the incidence of inherited disease is about twofold less in mixed breed dogs than it is in healthy dogs. But I would, in purebred dogs. But what I would really emphasize is that it depends for any given individual on who the parents or grandparents were of your dog. And if your dog got two bad copies of a particular gene that increases susceptibility to lymphoma, all the statistics in the world don't change anything when it's your dog that's sick and it's your dog that's dying. It really doesn't matter that it's a mutt or a purebred dog or it's papered or you got it at the pound.
Of course. And then we don't choose our dogs, generally speaking, by what their genetics are, right? We choose them by, you know, what's going to make a good family dog for us or a good individual dog for us, how much exercise they're going to require, whether they shed or don't shed, these kinds of factors.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting when you ask people how they picked the dog that they picked. And certainly there's a lot of consideration. Is it a good family dog? Are there people home during the day to walk the dog several times a day or exercise it? Or is it a dog that's going to have to entertain itself during the day? And certainly the apartment versus having some land and a larger home and a yard are big considerations. And some people like big dogs and some people like small dogs, and those all factor in. But, you know, people will often tell me, they'll say, you know, I wasn't planning on getting a dog, but the dog chose me. You know, I was over to friends, I was over to neighbors. My sister's dog just had puppies, my neighbor's dog just had puppies. And you know what? I came home with a dog. She chose me.
Well, all of life is kind of like that, right? We don't, you know, sometimes our various paths in life choose us. So many questions flooding into my mind. One is, there are things that humans have learned that we can do to reduce our chances of developing certain types of cancers.
Sure.
Are there environmental causes of cancers in dogs or certain behaviors that will increase a dog's risk of developing certain cancers?
Well, for humans, we certainly know that having a healthy diet with lots of vegetables and that's low in fat and reducing alcohol intake and increasing exercise are all things that can reduce...
Avoiding cigarette smoke, for instance?
Absolutely, absolutely. The number one is, of course, not smoking. These are all things that are important in reducing humans' risk of cancer. And we hope our dogs don't smoke, although there have been studies on secondhand smoke in dogs, and it's not really clear where that really stands. It's not a major cause of canine cancer. I think for dogs, the concern people have that's greatest is lawn pesticides and chemicals and fertilizers. And there have been a number of studies done addressing that issue. And you know, the data are a little bit hard to interpret, in part because of the whole issue of runoff that goes between your yard and your neighbor's yard and the guy up the street's yard and the organic garden down the street. And so, you know, some of those studies have been hard to interpret. But, you know, increasingly communities are really taking a stand about the kinds of pesticides and, more importantly, the kinds of solvents that you can use to dilute pesticides or lawn chemicals that may stay around long after the fertilizer and so on has been washed into the soil. So it's a very active area of research right now. And pet food companies and nutritionists, companion animal nutritionists, are looking really hard at the food we give our dogs. And I think everyone would agree that the standards of pet food have really, really improved over decades, over the last several decades, and that our dogs and our cats are getting, you know, much, much healthier, more nutritious food than they did decades ago. So, you know, the other thing is probably, just like with humans, there's no substitute for vigilance. You know, you feel a funny bump on your dog, don't wait 6 months. Get into the vet and find out what's going on. Because just like with humans, early detection is often the difference between life and death for these animals. So no substitute just for really good, vigilant care of your pet.
Good point. And then one last question, which is that I know so many people are so concerned with medical testing going on dogs that research that will ultimately, hopefully, help humans and in terms of the study of disease and that sort of thing. But I think it's important to point out that the research that you're doing isn't harming dogs in any way.
No, we don't keep any dogs in kennels. We don't breed any dogs. That's not how we work. We partner with the community and with organizations like Guide Dogs for the Blind. And we go to dog parks and dog shows and obedience trials and breed specialty clubs and give lots and lots of talks about the work that we're doing. And it's people like you and me who own a dog who say, you know, I have a West Highland White Terrier, and I know that bladder cancer is a problem in my breed. I'd like to give a sample if it could be helpful. And so we collect a cheek swab or we collect a blood sample. And those are the DNA samples that fill our freezers. So that's again why it's wonderful to be able to partner with an organization like Guide Dogs, because, you know, they're out there in the community wanting to do something, give these dogs a great job and a great life. I mean, companion animal dogs certainly, you know, love the life they have, that they're kept so busy and they have so much responsibility and they do something important. And certainly their owners love them. And so it's a really terrific opportunity for us to partner with a great organization. But, you know, I appreciate the sensitivity very, very much. And that's why we're very lucky that people have been so responsive to the work that we do and taken the time to understand how we collect our DNA samples. And then we've we've been very lucky to have great collaborators who have shared data and research and statistical methods and ideas with us as well. So all around, it's been a great, it's really just been a great ride for us.
If people want to, obviously, if they want to learn more, they can go to your site, which
sure.
is genome.gov, G-O-V. They could also go to guidedogs.com, which is the Guide Dogs for the Blind website.
Right.
But if people specifically think that their dog might be able to help in your research, or maybe they even have access to many more dogs, how can they let you know that they're available perhaps to help?
So if you go to our website, you'll find the email for our samples manager. So we have one full-time person, and her job is really just to go to the dog shows and the obedience trials and the dog specialties and to talk with owners and breeders and get in chat rooms.
I like that job. I want
yes,
that job.
We have a lot of people apply for it. It's a great job. And she will answer any questions anybody has. And if you want to talk to her about your dog and if your dog's DNA could be useful for one of our studies, she'll mail you or your veterinarian out a kit in order to collect a DNA sample. And everything is in the kit down to a return mailer that's already got our address on it. And you can put the sample in there and just drop it in the post office and postal approved mailers. And it comes back to us. And we send out periodic newsletters where we follow up with owners and breeders as to, you know, what's going on with the studies that they're participating in. And we also do a lot of updates via our website and via individual breed clubs' websites. We'll often write things for the websites that they can go ahead and post so people who have participated know what's going on. So if you go to that site at genome.gov and you go to the link, you'll find all the contact information for our samples manager, and she will be thrilled to hear from each and every one of you.
Elaine Ostrander, this has just been an absolutely fascinating interview. You're a delightful person, and congratulations on this fabulous research you're doing.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. And once again, let me share those websites with you. For Guide Dogs for the Blind, it's just guidedogs.com. And for Dr. Ostrander's project, genome, genome.gov. Thanks for all the input you've been providing. Just send an email with your name and your feedback, of course, to gooddog@smarterpodcasts.com.